represent perturbation theory in quantum field theory. In fact, since it's combinatorics, it really applies to any quantum mechanics, so one can use it for an harmonic oscillator in one dimension. But in quantum field theory, this is really indispensable. There is basically no other way to do perturbation theory. So Feynman diagrams are formed the most convenient approach. So I remind you that there were two ingredients in the lambda. So if the interaction Lagrangian is minus lambda over 24 phi to the 4, then perturbation theory contains two ingredients: vertices of interaction, and so each vertex contains a factor of minus I times lambda, and the four-dimensional integration over position of this vertex. And then vertices should be connected among themselves and with external lines by propagators. So each propagator corresponds to a contraction of two fields at points x and y. And so using these two elements, one can, in principle, calculate corrections to Green's functions to any ordered perturbation theory. Well, the diagrams as pictures, they represent just a way to organize the calculation. But then to really calculate the correction numerically, we need to know what this function is. And so it's time to understand what is the Feynman propagator as a function of x and y. This is what we're going to study next. So in principle, this is a function of eight variables. X and y are points in space-time. Symmetries reduce the number of independent variables to just one. So because of translational invariance, it should be a function of a difference. And by Lorentz invariance, one can realize that it really depends only on the invariant interval between points and between the events x and y. So it's really a function of one variable. And so let's compute it explicitly. Well, actually, we will not do an explicit calculation, but we'll do it in some explicit way. So first of all, by definition, d of x minus y, which is the same as contraction between phi x and phi y. And that was defined as a vacuum expectation value of time order product of two fields at points x and y in free Klein-Gordon theory. So in other words, it's a two-point function of free fields, two-point Green's function. So as such, we can compute it, the contraction, as we introduced it, came from commuting creation and annihilation operators. So the way to represent Green's functions as Feynman diagrams is, after all, a graphical depiction of how we commute A's and A daggers. And so we can compute this Green's function just plugging in the expression for the Heisenberg operators, rearranging the order of A and A daggers such that they annihilate the vacuum states on the left and on the right. And the remaining numerical term will give us the Green's function. So this calculation is given in the textbook, and I advise you to take a look at it because it's a useful exercise. But now I will compute it in some indirect way. So the idea is that the field operators satisfy the field equation. So if we act with the Klein-Gordon operator on phi of x, then we get zero. And this is an exact equation. It's just an operator equation. So we can, well, this is a differential operator. So we can apply this operator to the Green's function. So let's compute, say, the Green's function of, let's say, of between x and 0. So by translation invariance, we may always set y to 0 and then apply d squared plus m squared to d of x. What we then expect to get is basically, well, we expect that it will be 0, right? It's equal to time order product d squared plus m squared phi of x. Then another phi is evaluated at 0, so it doesn't depend on x. And this is 0. But in fact, this calculation is not completely correct. So there are some extra terms that are called Schwinger terms. So these terms arise because phi is not really a function, it's an operator. So it doesn't commute at two different points. And this quantum non-commutativity leads to yes. For technical convenience, because you say it's a function of x minus y, so if you know, well, it depends only on the difference. So we can always set y to 0, and then we will know the whole function. So these terms arise because of the quantum non-commutativity. And this is the simplest example of anomaly. So anomaly is, well, general definition is something that we think is zero, but which is not zero. So let us see how it arises in this case. Well, what goes wrong in this calculation is that we cannot interchange the order of time ordering, and differentiation with respect to x. So if we do things more carefully, we should recall that time ordering, well, it really means that the operators are ordered depending on the time component of x. So if the time component is positive, so if x0 is positive, then we should take them literally in the same order. So the time should flow from right to left in any time ordered expression. So if x0 is negative, then we should take the product in the opposite order. So theta here is the step function. It is equal to 1 for positive argument and 0 for the negative argument. So you see, written in this way, it becomes clear that time ordering itself depends on x. So when we differentiate, the derivatives will act on phi, but also on this time ordering step functions. Okay, so and this will pick up an extra term that is actually not so difficult to calculate. And this extra term, well, it has to be taken into account. So let's do this differentiation. So this is actually D'Alembert operator, and it contains second time derivative. So the theta functions depend only on time. And so what's left is the terms in which derivative acts both on thetas and on phi. So at least it acts, I mean, terms in which it acts non-trivial on theta. So we can write this, well, let's see what we will have. So we want to differentiate this twice in time. Okay, so then this will be equal to second derivative acting on x0. Phi of x, phi of 0, plus twice the term where when derivative acts on theta and on phi. Plus the term where second derivative acts only on phi. Right, and then there will be terms in which, essentially x0 is replaced to minus x0 in theta. And the order of operators is different, okay? So this term combines with the rest to produce zero. So what we are missing are these two terms, okay? And the similar terms in the other case where we act on theta of minus x. So these terms always contain derivative x acting on theta. Now, if we differentiate the step function, what we get is the delta function. So there is and then we can write the Schwinger terms. Is equal to to what is left after we remove the after we use the equations of motion. So let me write it that way. So this will be equal to so let's look at this term. So this will be proportional to the delta function. And then it will contain the derivative of phi with respect to time times phi of 0 and plus the similar term that comes from differentiating this theta with the negative argument. So since the argument is negative, this term will come with an opposite sign, and also the order of operator is switched, right? So this means that the coefficient is nothing but commutator of d0 phi of x with phi of 0. And then in principle, there is a coefficient of 2 here, but for some reasons, it will be convenient to combine one of these terms with this one, so we can write it as t0 delta of x0 and then commutator of phi of x is phi of 0. So now something very interesting has happened. So since this, first of all, we got everything reduced to commutators. So if phi were a number, these terms would vanish. So they don't vanish only because fields do not commute really at different points. So they are operators. Secondly, these commutators are taken at zero time. So because they're multiplied by the delta function, they're evaluated at the moment when x0 is 0. And at this moment, there is no difference between Heisenberg and Schrodinger operators, because Heisenberg operators, well, they're just the same as Schrodinger operators evolved through the time interval t. So if you evaluate them at zero time, they're the same. And we know how Schrodinger operators commute among themselves. So what we have there is really delta of x0. And then we have time derivative of phi, but we know what it is. This is the conjugate momentum to the field variable. So this is actually pi of x0, zero x with phi of 0. And then in the second term, we have a time derivative of delta of x0 and then a commutator of phi with itself. So everything reduced to commutators of canonical variables of so field is a canonical. I mean, we started with canonical formalism when we discussed Klein-Gordon field, and then phi plays the role of Q, and there is a conjugate momentum to it. So of course, Q commutator with Q is zero, so this term is vanishes, but this term is equal to the delta function. So this is equal to delta of x. Okay, so what we got is a four-dimensional delta function. Times I, or minus I, let me see. Minus I, right? So P commutator with Q is minus I times the delta. So finally, the Schwinger term is equal to minus I times the delta, four-dimensional delta of X. So all in all, we conclude that the propagator satisfies the field equation, the Klein-Gordon equation, but with the right-hand side. So we can simply solve this equation to compute the propagator. And since this is a linear equation with constant coefficients, we solve it by Fourier transform. So in Fourier space, this will be an algebraic equation. On the left-hand side becomes p squared minus m squared. and we have the Fourier image of the propagator. And on the right-hand side, we have Fourier image of delta, which is just equal to 1. Oh, this is easy to invert. So we find that the Fourier image of the propagator is equal to I divided by pi squared minus m squared. So returning back to the X representation, we should do the Fourier integral of this. And now we encounter a difficulty, because strictly speaking, this integral is not defined. So when p squared is equal to m squared, the integrand has a pole. So it seems that the integral diverges. And it diverges precisely when the momentum satisfies the usual initial condition. So when p squared is equal to m squared, so that it is a physical momentum of a Klein-Gordon particle. So what goes wrong here? Well, the reason for this divergence is that it can be traced back to the equation with which we started. So this is a second order differential equation in partial derivatives. So it has the solution should depend on the boundary conditions, right? So in principle, there should be two boundary functions that determine the solution completely. So think of, for instance, wave equation when m is equal to 0. So then the general solution will be, will be waves of moving at the speed of light. But of course, we need to put boundary conditions to determine the precise shape of the wave. So equation itself is insufficient to determine the function unambiguously. And here it is reflected in the appearance of the poles in the integration axis. So in principle, so what we should do is we should encircle this pole, so shift them from the integration contour in the complex plane. And this can be done in a multitude of ways, which parameterize the possible boundary conditions for the Klein-Gordon equation. So if we draw the P0 plane, then this is okay. P0 is the lower index. So there will be two poles at position minus E P and the position plus E P, where E P is square root of P squared plus M squared. So the integrand has singularities at these points. And in principle, we can draw the contour. Well, we should shift the contour in such a way that it doesn't pass exactly through the singularities. And so, in other words, we need to impose some boundary conditions on this equation. And we can guess which boundary conditions are correct. If you recall the one of the tricks that was used in deriving the Green's function, namely that we can pick up the correct ground state if we shift the contour in the complex plane of time. Now, the energy P0 is the canonically conjugate variable to time, so here it multiplies time, so P0 multiplies x. So if you rotate time integration axis through the angle epsilon in the clockwise direction, the energy, this is equivalent to rotating energy integration axis in the opposite direction through the same angle. So we can undo this time rotation of the time axis by rotating the energy axis. So the energy axis should, in fact, be tilted with respect to the real axis by an angle that is infinitesimally small. So we rotate it through angle epsilon, and then epsilon goes to zero. So this would produce the this is consistent with the boundary conditions in time, so that at that we pick up the correct ground state. So in other words, if we rotate the contour this way, then we can continue our Green's function in that. So their continuation in imaginary time will produce the right ground state at plus and minus infinity. So this is the physical meaning of this prescription to go around the poles. So this epsilon prescription is actually necessary to pick up the correct ground state. So usually this contour is drawn a little bit differently. So many times one can see a picture where the contour goes for the most part along the imaginary axis, then encircles the pole on the negative part of the real, so the negative pole from below, and the positive pole from above. And this is actually equivalent to that picture, because we can always deform the contour since the integrand is an analytic function of P0, so we can deform small deformations of the contour as long as they don't cross the poles, they don't change the result of the integration. So this is this way of encircling the poles is called Feynman prescription. And there is a nice way to represent it. So you say that we need to, we can also draw a third picture, again equivalent to the other two ones. So instead of shifting the contour of integration, we can shift the poles. So we can say that we integrate really along the real line, but we shift the positive pole a little bit below the real line and the negative pole a little bit above. So this should lie in negative energy half plane, and this in the positive. Okay, so this means that what we should do is we should replace, let's see, so so analytically, for me at least, the simplest picture is the original one with the tilted contour, because then we simply replace P by P multiplied or divided by 1 minus I epsilon, right? So this is equivalent to x zero being multiplied by 1 minus I epsilon. And so approximately, since epsilon is very small, we say that we shift epsilon by I epsilon P0. So in terms of this picture, this means that if you are close to this pole, its position is so its position is shifted to the negative axis because P0 then is positive. Okay, so let me write the final answer. So then P0 squared is shifted to P0 plus I epsilon P0 squared, which is approximately P0 squared plus 2I P0 epsilon. Squared, but then this is positive, so we can simply redefine epsilon. So this is what matters is actually the sign of epsilon. So we can write that this is P0 squared plus epsilon tilde. And since epsilon goes to zero, it doesn't matter that it's tilde, that it has tilde or not. Sorry? This epsilon is infinitesimally small. I can absorb P0 squared into it. So, yes?
I don't understand how to pick which pole to go over and which pole to go under. Like, why could we just.
This picture?
Under this one and under, over the one to the right. Why isn't it the opposite?
Why, let's see, so how to go from this picture to that picture?
No,
from
why did we choose a line like that and not a line like
that? And not like that, like that. This is because we want to shift x0 in the, so we want to tilt the time axis in the clockwise direction. So this was our prescription how to pick the correct vacuum, because then the so that prescription came from, well, evolving the state, which contains other eigenstates except for the vacuum. And they pick up exponentials that are either suppressed or enhanced depending on the sign of epsilon. So in the case where they're suppressed, and this determines the sign, the direction in which we rotate the time axis. Now, in the integral, we have exponential that contains P0 times t, P0 x0, right? And then if we we should change this to P0 x 0 1 minus I epsilon, and then divided by 1 minus I epsilon, right? So this would give us the correct prescription for in time. And so the correct prescription in the for the energy is to divide by this factor. So this uniquely determines the direction in which we should rotate. So we should rotate in the opposite direction to the time complex plane. So that defines the way we encircle the poles. So at the end, I claim that the Feynman propagator is given by the integral where the whole integrand contains plus I epsilon. So this I epsilon simply determines how we should encircle the poles. And so you can check that near the pole, what do we have? So near the pole, we have pi 0 squared minus epsilon squared plus I epsilon. So this is equal to 0. So pi 0 that is never equal to 0. Well, this is equal to 0 for some complex pi 0, right? So we now are in this picture. We see where are the poles. So the poles are at, so pi 0 squared is e squared minus I epsilon. And if you take the square root, so let's see. How to do it in a so this means that pi 0 is at plus minus e minus plus I epsilon. So if you take the square, then epsilon comes out with the correct sign, so with this prescription, which means that the positive pole lies a little bit below the axis and the negative a little bit above. So this is the prescription that, well, comes out from essentially picking up the correct ground state, and it determines completely the boundary conditions for the Klein-Gordon equations that we should use. So so here is the answer. This is the Feynman propagator. And in principle, one can do the integral explicitly and find it as a function of x. It's given in terms of the Hankel function. Yes? Because the tilting of the time axis was important for picking up the correct ground state. So in all calculation, in principle, we should remember that time must have an imaginary part. So in this Fourier transform, this is the same as giving some imaginary part to energy. And so we should rotate the contour of energy in the opposite direction to be able, so after integration, to rotate the time contour in the right direction. So if we were to use some other prescription, then the Green's function will simply not have good analytic continuation in time that, I mean, will give the right boundary conditions. But anyway, so one can view this as just a prescription. And the reason behind this prescription is that we want to have the right boundary conditions at plus minus infinity in time. So anyway, if you use this integral representation, we can integrate, but that's not very convenient. You see that the Fourier transform of the Green's function looks much simpler than its X space representation. So the idea is that we can transform the whole set of Feynman rules in the momentum space. And then the propagator is a simple rational function. And this really simplifies this integral a lot. And also, the physical picture becomes very, very transparent. So let's see. So then the propagator now it has momentum running through it. So we should assign momentum to each propagator. And you see that so the factor that corresponds to each propagator then is I divided by p squared minus m squared plus I epsilon. And also, there is this exponential. So the all x dependents sit in this Fourier exponential. So which can be so divided into pieces. So this is originally this was d of x minus y. And so we can write this as e to the I p y. So if this is point y, and e to the minus ipx. So then now the sign of momentum, of course, is important here because, right, so the changing sign of p will change the sign of x and y. And so this arrow is really a directed arrow. So the momentum flows in this particular direction. And the way to understand this physically is that this is really a momentum of a particle that was created here. So recall that in the field operator, the creation operator, a dagger is multiplied by the exponent with positive sign and the annihilation operator by the exponent with the negative sign. So this is really a momentum. One can think of this as a momentum of a particle created at point y. Then it moves with the momentum p and is annihilated at point x. OK, and then, yes. Yeah, that's bad. Okay. Should go from positive exponent to negative exponent. So let's see what happens in the vertices. So in the vertex, we have four lines. That there are four lines that meet at each vertex. And so each line carries momentum. And so let's assume that this momenta are all outgoing. So there's momentum P1, momentum P2, momentum P3, and momentum P4. And then there is the position of x point of this point, which is x. And we should integrate over x. So we know that each of these propagators contains a factor of, so since this is the outgoing moment, it will be equal to, so each moment, each propagator will carry a factor of e to the I px. So we'll have e to the I p1x plus e to the I p2x plus p3x plus p4x. Well, and even though this momentum in the diagram can be a part of some complicated diagram, there is no other place where x can appear, right? So in the X representation, X enters only, four propagators, right? So this propagator is dx minus some other point with which it is connected. This depends on X, that depends on X, and this depends on X. And now all this dependence has factorized because, now X-dependent factors sit on the endpoints of the propagator. So we can simply integrate here over x. And what we get is the delta function. So that is equal to minus I lambda times 2 pi to the 4, and then delta function of p1 plus p2 plus p3 plus p4. So which simply means that the total four momentum is conserved at each vertex. So there is no momentum flowing. The momentum should adapt to zero. Really, this does not depend much on the directions of momentum. So if we were to start with the vertex in which some of the lines were ingoing and others were outgoing, then this would be equal to minus I lambda 2 pi to the 4. And then delta function should take into account the directions. So this will be equal to p1 plus p2 minus p3 minus p4. And so finally, we can get rid of all x integrations, and only the momentum integrations will be left. So Feynman rules can be reformulated in the following way. So we should assign to each vertex the momentum conserving delta function. So this will be equal to minus I lambda delta and then sum of all momenta. And so directions here are important. So momenta should be taken with their signs. So each propagator now carries a momentum. although its value does not depend on the direction. And then we should multiply all factors and integrate over all momentum.
Question?
Yes?
What happened with the
Nothing, I simply forgot to write it. Now, this really produces the Fourier image of the Green's function. Right? So what we will get is the So the, in fact, many of these integrations over momenta are just trivial, because we have lots of delta functions, right? So we have, if you have n vertices, we can do n integration over momenta trivially, just by solving the momentum conservation conditions at each vertex. So this can be actually done beforehand, so we can simply assign momentum to the lines, taking into account the momentum conservation. And then only the leftover momentum should be integrated out. Yes?
So you already integrate over the momentum, the momentum integrals carry the 1 over 2 pi to the quadrature as well?
Yes. So this 2 pi will cancel. So at the end, we can simply assign minus I to the lambda to the vertices, and assign momentum is using the Kirchhoff rule. So this is like, you know, the momentum flows through the all, through all lines, but it should be conserved at each vertex. So maybe I should give some example where this, it will be clear what, how to use the Feynman rules. So let's, for instance, consider this diagram. So this diagram has two vertices, meaning that it is a correction for the lambda squared to the two-point Green's function of the Klein-Gordon particle. So we start with the propagator here. And let's say that momentum going through the diagram is equal to p. So then in this vertex, it it divides in three parts. So let's call the momentum flowing through this line K. Through this line Q. But then the momentum on this line is determined by momentum conservation condition in the vertex. So the momentum here will be equal to P minus K minus Q. And then you see that here this momentum are all combines again to the to momentum P. So there is no other choice. So momentum conservation tells you that there is just a single momentum flowing through the whole diagram, and it is conserved. And the reason that we got only one, so this is a two-point function, but we got only one Fourier variable. Which is not surprising because the two-point Green's function depends only on the difference of the endpoints, And so we only need one Fourier integral to represent it. So let's write out an analytic expression that corresponds to this diagram. Well, let's start with the vertices. So there is one and two vertices. So the diagram will be proportional to minus I lambda squared. Then the hard part is the symmetry factor. I claim that the symmetry of this diagram, there are six transformations that leave it invariant. And this is tough to compute. So the best way to do it is to start with the, so if you don't want to make a mistake, and if you have to do some diagram calculation, which if you become physicist is very high probability, you will have to do at some point. So for the beginning, it's better to start with the weak theorem and write long expressions with fields, field operators, two weak contractions, and only then represent the result as a diagram. It takes more time, but it's, I mean, guarantees that you don't make a mistake in all factors, because in the diagram technique, figuring out science and symmetry factors is a little bit tricky. Anyway, so there is one factor of six, which is a symmetry factor. Then there will be double momentum integration. And finally, we should multiply all propagators. So there will be these three propagators give I cubed divided by k squared minus m squared, q squared minus m squared, and finally p minus k minus q squared minus m squared. And then there are two propagators that are external to this diagram, which just give a factor of, I'm sorry, it's I divided by p squared minus m squared squared. Okay, so the integral only concerns these three propagators. And there's the whole technique how to calculate these integrals, but this goes beyond beyond this course. So this is just an example how you use, how you go from pictures to integrals. Any questions about, yes? I just didn't write them down. One can simply remember that they are there. So at some point when one really needs to do the to do the integration, one should remember that they're there. Yes?
The original Green's function depended on the positions of the external points, x1 and x2.
Yes.
What happens with these? Would be also Fourier transformed them?
So this is Fourier transformed. So this gives correction to G of P, which is D let me write it this way. So G of X1, X2 is equal to D4 P divided by 2 pi to the 4 e to the minus I P X1 minus X2 times G of P. And so this will be a correction to G of P. And there is really one integration variable here, one momentum. Any other questions? Well, then I'll continue a little bit to well, to the next topic, which is which concerns of real physical quantities that we can compute with the Feynman diagrams. So the Green's function is a sort of an auxiliary object. Yes. Let me see. So the one multiplying, let's see. So the positive exponential, the positive exponent should be the starting point. So this would be x2.
But isn't it the other way around now?
That's right. So indeed, yes. So that's also true. But formally speaking, we start with positive exponential. So this is x2. But yeah, indeed, everything is symmetric. So now we want to calculate something that relates directly to physics, unlike Green's functions. So what we'll discuss are amplitudes, cross sections, and decay rates. So the physical situation that we will keep in mind is the following. So suppose that at some initial time, which we'll take to be very far back in the past, we have particles with momentum, say, p1, p2. Then they come close to one another, collide. Something happens. And then there, as a result of this collision, there are some other particles produced with definite momentum. So this is, of course, an idealization. So the real collisions happen at finite time. But of course, the time of collision is very, very short. So usually these processes are described as if they take really infinite amount of time. And this is a typical, problem that one encounters, say, when describing particle collisions in accelerators, but also in statistical physics when the one describes, say, motion of electrons and ions in plasma or just atoms in a gas. Although I should say that there it's not quite clear that one can make an approximation that the time between collisions is really infinite. Real rigorous understanding of how to apply this formalism to statistical physics was developed actually by Behm and Kadanoff and some while ago. So I'll not talk about that. So what we will discuss is the computation of the object that describes this time evolution from minus infinity to plus infinity, so that we have, suppose that we have an in state that is a state of some number of particles characterized by their momenta. Well, of course, physically interesting cases are when the number of particles in the in state 2 or 1. So 1 will describe a decay of an unstable particle, and 2 will describe collision of 2 particles. So triple collisions is a very rare thing, because I mean it's very hard to arrange 3 particles to meet at one same point. But formally we can discuss an arbitrary number of particles in the in-state, and then they produce some set of particles in the final state. So the operator, so this is at t equals minus infinity, and this is at t equals plus infinity. So the operator that maps in states to the out state is called the S matrix. So we will, what we will want to do is to compute the matrix elements of the S matrix. So the claim is that the matrix elements of the S matrix can be calculated using Feynman diagrams, because this, so there is a formula very similar to the formula for the Green's functions. So that we have out state, then S, and then the in state. So this is given by the expectation value of this the evolution operator. Between in and out states. And so the evolution operator can be written as the t exponent. So we should calculate this matrix element and then divide it by the matrix element between the vacuum state. So this formula computes the matrix elements of this matrix, and since it's written as expectation value of t exponents of in the interaction picture, then we can use Feynman rules to compute it in perturbation theory. The only thing we need to know is to how to deal with the initial and final states when we apply the weak theory. And then, okay, so the physical meaning of this matrix element is that it gives probability amplitude of the process of this type. So this computes amplitudes. Of the scattering processes. And then, as I mean, in general, in quantum mechanics, if you want to find the probability, then we should take the amplitude, take its absolute value, and then take the square. Now, so of course, this in and out states, they're just created by creation and annihilation operators. So when we compute this amplitude, so we have an, let's see, the out state, then we'll have some vectors here that will contain field operators. And then in the in state, we will have a creation operator with some momentum acting on, well, on the ground state, right? So there will be many operators, but we want to understand what will happen if we pair phi with A. So this pairing arises when we take the annihilation operator from phi and commute it through all creation operators to the right. So once we commute it through all creation operators, it will annihilate the vacuum. So this will pick up the commutator of phi with A dagger. So this is basically the commutator, so phi x of A pi. And this is equal to, well, if you remember how the Heisenberg operator looks like, so this will be equal to E, 1 over square root of 2E. And then E to the minus IPX. So recalling that the initial, the correct normalization contains a factor of square root of 2e, we will see that the contraction of phi of x with one of the initial momenta will simply be equal to e to the minus ip ix. So in the X representation, if we want to compute the amplitude with some initial and final particles, then each initial particle in the Feynman diagram carries a factor of minus I px, and final particles will carry factors of e to the plus I p prime x, right? So if you do Fourier transform, these factors disappear. So in momentum space, there are simply external lines in amplitudes don't carry any factors at all. So Feynman rules for amplitudes are, in this sense, are very simple. So you just assign, you know, initial and final momenta. You need to assign momenta to internal lines, and then integrate over internal momenta. And this will give you the matrix element of the amplitude of some scattering process. So let me give an example. So for instance, let us consider two to two scattering in lambda phi four theory. So we have initial state, which is state with two momenta p1 and p2. And then we have final state with momenta p1 prime, p2 prime. So to the leading order in perturbation theory, the lowest order diagram is this one, which so there will be. So the only difference between initial and final particles is that so the initial momentum should be incoming, and the final momentum should be outgoing. Pi 1 prime, pi 2 prime. And so the only factor that appears here is, well, there will be a factor of minus I lambda, and then the delta function that describes the momentum conservation of, well, conservation of energy and momentum. So this is the leading contribution to the amplitude in lambda phi 4 theory. Any questions? Well, strictly speaking, there are also diagrams like that, and like that. But those should be. One should throw them away, so they should be. They do not contribute. So the full set of Feynman rules also includes that the rule that you shouldn't take into account disconnected diagrams. So to compute the amplitude, you really need to consider only diagrams that cannot be divided into two independent parts. And also the diagrams where loop corrections appear on the external lines also should not be considered. So for instance, this diagram should not be taken into account. Yes?
Can you explain more in detail how which diagrams we consider connected, which we consider disconnected? For example, if we have like four external legs, and why do we consider a diagram where like two legs are connected and two other legs are connected? Why do we consider it disconnected? Why does it eliminate in the end?
So why should we disregard these diagrams? That's a little bit difficult to explain. So one has to really look to that formula and understand what it means. So one has to actually subtract some terms from it. And yes.
In denominator, we only have diagrams that are like closed.
That's right. So literally, this formula only eliminates vacuum bubbles. But the amplitudes, so one should write the S matrix as 1 plus IT, where, so this 1 describes trivial scattering. Nothing happens, right? So initial state is equal to final state. So what we are interested in is the matrix elements of T. So they really describe the probabilities of the real process that happens. So subtracting this one essentially eliminates some diagrams. So one can understand it in the diagrammatic language. And this is the diagrams that contain disconnected sets of lines that you can, I mean, that describe really some disconnected subprocesses. For instance, if you consider, say, 4-to-4 process, then it you can draw diagrams that connect pairwise interactions. So, physically, this describes scattering, independent scattering of particles 1 and 2 and 3 and 4. So this shouldn't be regarded as really a 4 by 4 scattering. So one has to subtract it. So there are some subtleties involved in application of that formula. So it does not produce directly all the amplitudes. One has to really eliminate certain parts of it. Okay, if there are no more questions, then thank you and see you tomorrow.